Hello to welcome to a new episode of Fan Ostwärts, this time recorded in Taipei, just a few days, just over a week after the Taiwanese presidential election. And we have two returnees on the podcast today. One is Brian Hugh from New Bloom.
Thanks for having me.
And the other is Levin Ackman, a PhD student at UC Irvine and a Fulbright scholar in Taiwan.
Thanks for having me too.
Thanks for agreeing to do this after you've already extensively written about and spoken to media about the elections. A couple of days ago, so on January 11th, Tsai Ing-wen was re-elected as president of Taiwan, and she also retained her majority in the Legislative Yuan. So that's kind of like the outline of what happened, and I was hoping that we might be able to go a bit deeper into the events both for and after the election. The last time we did something on the election was in August when Lev, you talked to us about how the campaign had been going. And at the time, it looked really like a bit dire for Tsai. And her challenger, Han from the KMT, was looking like he could maybe sweep to a populist victory. So what happened? Like, Tsai won with like a massive landslide with more than 8 million votes. Like, how did she become so popular over the past half year?
So before we get too into it, I think it's worth talking about just very quickly going over how Taiwan's electoral system works, because when we talk about who won and by how much, there's actually a few different moving parts at play and a few different numbers to pay attention to beyond just the presidential results. So very quickly, Taiwan is a mixed electoral system, meaning that it uses components of a first-past-the-post system and a proportional representation system. So a first-past-the-post system is usually two candidates who run, and the person who wins is whoever has the most votes. So that's typically how America chooses our president and our senators and representatives. Meanwhile, a party list is when people vote for an individual party, and the party itself decides how many and who gets in based off of the proportional percentage of the votes that they get. So, for example, if there's a 100-person parliament and there's four parties and each party gets 25% of the votes, then each party gets 25 members in parliament. That's typical to how Germany does their parliamentary system. So in Taiwan, when people go to the ballot box to vote, they vote three times. First for the president, then for their local district representative. But Taiwan has a third vote, which is a party vote. So even if there's only a DPP and a KMT candidate running in your district, Taiwanese voters can still vote for whatever party they want to vote for. So then if we look, so that's just a quick system overview. So if we look at the numbers of how Tsai Ing-wen did, how the DPP did, both on the party list and on in the legislature as a whole, we actually see that it was a definite landslide victory for Tsai in terms of numbers, but it wasn't a landslide victory for the DPP. In fact, the DPP actually lost seats overall. They maintained their majority, but they actually have a few. They have fewer seats now. The KMT has a few more seats than they did last time. Just to start off the conversation, let Brian jump in. I think it's important to also note that when we think about that size victory, it was a landslide victory in the sense that she won by what I think 2 million votes. But Han Kuo-yu also still received 5.5 million votes. And if we compare this to the 2016 election, Eric Chu, Zhu Lilun, actually got 3.5 million votes. So even though Han Kuo-yu lost, the KMT presidential candidate still received 2 million more votes than they did last election. And then if we look at the proportional representation numbers, so even though that in the Legislative Yuan, the DPP still has a majority, if you look at the party vote, which, you know, to some degree, the party vote is a bit of a de facto referendum on how, you know, society feels about their preference of parties. The DPP and the KMT tied. The DPP got 34%, the KMT got 33%. And third parties received 30% of the PR votes, which we can talk more about that later. But the important thing for now is that the DPP did not exceedingly outperform the KMT on the party list. They did just as well. And what this can kind of tell us is that this most certainly was Taiwanese voters... Not a clear signal that they did not want Han Kuo-yu to win, that they wanted Tsai Ing-wen. But this was not an endorsement of Tsai Ing-wen's party. It was not an endorsement of the DPP. At the same time, this was not a total rejection of the KMT in the way that I think many people see this election to be.
Brian, how would you characterize like your main takeaways from the results?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that it is that people did not want Hangoryu. Hangoryu seemed just like a very ineffective candidate. He made many mistakes. He had frequent gaffes and so forth. And though he was very popular last year when he became the mayor of Kaohsiung, his popularity kind of did take a rapid inversal in the past few months. Han was seen as different from other KMT candidates because of his populist political style, that he was able to win over demographics that other KMT voters, other KMT candidates didn't seem to be able to appeal to, such as, for example, young people. But that changed in the past year in which he began to leverage more on ROC nationalism and so forth. But then that's something that voters ended up projecting. And I think there's multiple reasons for that. I mean, one is that fear of closer relations with China, but then also fear of Han himself as a candidate, that he was seen as ineffective and irregular as a politician. And so the DPP retains power, but then the KMT has gained some ground back. At the same time, the KMT is in this kind of internal crisis mode right now because they haven't figured out what to do about their cross-strait policy. They realize they were punished this time on the basis of that their cross-strait policy did not appeal to voters. But in the sense that I think voters still are willing to punch the DPP for, I think, slow economic growth and just kind of ineffective governments or flip-flopping on political issues. And so I think it's a real question what we see now going forward.
So I think you already mentioned KMT's cross-strait policy. So I think it's maybe worth talking about what this election was about. So like, how would you characterize kind of like how the two main parties ran? Like, what did they basically run on? Han versus Tsai.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is that a lot of the discussion in terms of public discourse did not actually focus too much on the concrete of details of policy this time. For example, just the DPP would often bring up Hong Kong as an issue to avoid talking about specific economic policy and so forth, just because it does raise these kind of older issues regarding independence and unification in a new way. And then the KMT again claims that it's the party of economic growth and stability. There's a need for some kind of more stable relation with China, which the DPP is not able to offer. And then it leverages on its traditional issues, such as claiming that's in support of nuclear energy to maintain a stable energy supply, kind of whiff-waffling on some issues, such as gay marriage. Initially, many party members are opposed to gay marriage, but then Han later on just made some kind of vague statement, sort of kind of supporting it. And so then it's actually just, I think it goes back to these kind of older issues regarding independence and unification, that's the fundamental split in Taiwanese politics, and this has not gone away.
I think it's also, I reference this a lot, but I know that there's good political science research that shows that during presidential elections in particular, that unification and independence is the most salient issue for Taiwan voters. It's not to say that other issues don't matter, but in Taiwan, it's very difficult to talk about any sort of other political issue during a presidential election without tying it to what it means for unification and independence. So for example, one of Hangoryu's big slogans was, and I'm going to totally butcher this because I don't remember the exact words, but it was like, "民眾有錢, Taiwan 安全," or like, you know, when the people have money, Taiwan is safe, or Taiwan is rich, people are safe. And I think that's kind of the way that they try to articulate their pro-China policy. Meanwhile, the DPP very much used Hong Kong to articulate and frame their pro-Taiwan sovereignty stance. And I think ultimately that was a very successful tactic for Tsai to mobilize a lot of people. It most certainly wasn't the only thing that led to Tsai's victory, but it definitely was an important factor. At the same time, I think it was a matter of the KMT and Hangoryu didn't really have that same kind of mobilizing factor that really convinced people to vote for him as president over Tsai. I think Tsai Ing-wen definitely articulated that she was going to do the most, or at the very least, that she would fight the most to maintain Taiwan's sovereignty. Now, what exactly she's going to do or what exact concrete policy proposals she proposed, well, there weren't any, but she invoked Hong Kong a lot, and that made people think she was going to defend Taiwan's sovereignty. And Han Kuo-yu just didn't have a response. It's not that Han articulated a different version of defending Taiwanese sovereignty. It's Han didn't even articulate it. And this is what I really, you know, I know it's very easy to paint this as a Tsai overwhelming victory, but like the fact that Han still got 5.5 million votes with this atrocious election and with falling in the polls the last 6 months. And, you know, it just, to me, does not, it, obviously this was a victory for the DPP, but it doesn't feel like that landslide victory that I think it's kind of getting portrayed as right now.
Yeah, I think people just tend to hone in on the fact that historically, I mean, the DPP only ever controlled the presidency and legislature one time before this, which was just Tsai's first term. That was the only first time in history that the DPP controlled the legislature, that a non-KMT party controlled the legislature. And now this is like a second time, but also then, it doesn't mean that Tsai has the overwhelming mandate of society. That's also something quite interesting. Han actually leveraged particularly on the notion that the Republic of China was under assault, that the Republic of China and its national identity was under assault because of these so-called Taiwanese independence forces. But that did not turn out to be a winning formula, I think, in mobilizing voters out of this kind of sense of outrage or this wounded nationalism even.
One thing I'd be interested in is talking about this phenomenon of Han Kuo-yu. Like, he swept to becoming mayor of Kaohsiung in 2018, like, really surprisingly. And then even towards the end of the election, although, like you said, he still got more than 5 million votes, although he didn't win, there was definitely still like enthusiasm for him. So what was he mobilizing? Like, who were the people who he got to come out to his rallies and be excited about him? Like, what was that about?
I think a lot of times voters were looking for some kind of vision of hope and change, and that's kind of what he was able to offer in 2018. Tsai, for example, swept to office similarly, claiming that she would change Taiwan in 2016. I think voters just are really kind of tired of this kind of establishment politician that is maybe too slick about... I think voters are maybe a little tired of this kind of establishment politician who is maybe good with words, can speak in terms of concrete policies and rattle off a lot of facts, but doesn't seem to connect with voters on an emotional level. And so many people will describe Han as someone that is able to do that, somebody that's unorthodox. And so populism is used as a frame to describe Han as this kind of right-wing populist. And I can't deny that there's a lot of salience to that. I think that Han, that was his appeal, actually, to voters. And that's why he had such a devoted following. I think even now, despite his losses, I mean, there are people calling for him to run for KMT party chair. And so he was able to inspire this kind of mass of people to support him. But this is not actually the whole of Taiwanese society. It was actually still a selective group that felt disenfranchised. For example, one of the issues was that public servants, members of military, police, and teachers, their pensions were cut by the Tsai administration in order to save the pension system. The pension system is used historically to reward this group of people in return for political loyalty, because this was a key demographic you needed on your side if you wanted to run a successful one-party state during KMT authoritarian times. But then he was leveraging on the outrage of these people that they felt that their privileges were being taken away and so forth. But I think that just still didn't resonate with the public at large. The public still would have preferred Tsai. I mean, I think also a lot of it's by default that people preferred Tsai. It wasn't that she actually did offer some kind of vision of hope and change, which overwhelmed Han's or anything he had in that direction. But yeah.
I also think it's a matter of remembering that I don't know if there's specific research done on Taiwan, but I know in the U.S. that there's a large percentage of Republican and Democrats that will vote party no matter what. That's how you kind of explain away a lot of Donald Trump support, is that a lot of Republicans will just want a Republican in the White House and doesn't matter who. And I imagine that a similar sentiment exists for KMT DPP voters as well, especially within the KMT. Like, I think there's definitely a large number of KMT supporters who, even if they're not crazy about Han, be it ROC nationalism or just loyalty to the KMT as a party, I think are going to vote for the KMT no matter what.
I've also heard one thing that I encountered a lot in the run-up to the election was people talking about like polarization and how they were saying that nobody really talks to anyone else anymore. So do we have a sense of whether Tsai won because she actually was able to convince more people of her vision or like whatever she stood for, even if there were no concrete policy proposals? Or was it just that she was more successful at getting people to come vote who would have voted DPP anyway?
I think it's the latter. And I think the number you can look at is voter turnout rate from this election to last election. And then some of the more specific numbers comparing the two. So first of all, in 2016, James Song got 1.5 million votes. And this election, he only got 500,000 votes. And I say with certainty that those million votes probably went to Han Kuo-yu.
With mentioning that Song was a third party.
Song was a third party and a former KMT politician who broke off from the KMT for internal politics reasons, not because of ideological differences. And so then if you look, that there's 10% more voters this election. So 2 million more voters voted this election, and Tsai won with 2 million more votes than Han. And that's not to say that if these voters had stayed home, that Tsai would have lost. I think she still probably would have won, but probably by not nearly as much of a margin. I think Tsai's strategy, I mean, even if you look at their use of Hong Kong, invoking Hong Kong isn't to try to convince blue voters to vote green.
Blue or KMT, more voters. Pro-Chinese and green is
the DPP's color. It's not about convincing blue voters to vote green. It's about convincing green voters who probably might have stayed home during the election to come out and vote. And the way that the reason I think that is because there's a great piece of new data put out by a political scientist named Tim Rich, who studies political science, Timothy Rich. And he showed that blue voters don't care about Hong Kong. Green voters care about Hong Kong. And not only that, but there's also an age difference. So young green voters care about Hong Kong the most. And so what that tells me is that this use of Hong Kong as a frame is about trying to convince young green voters to vote. Because these Hong Kong frames don't do anything for old blue voters.
Yeah, and I was saying even in the pan-green camp, you see much more mention of Hong Kong at the rallies that are geared towards younger people, for example. There's much more greater focus on that. Whereas I think a lot of times you have the independence unification issue framed in kind of the traditional lens in these kind of rallies that are attended by older pan-green voters. I think that also the Han campaign really tried to draw a distinction between the 1992 consensus, which it advocates for, and one country, two systems as applied to Hong Kong, despite the fact that this notion of one country, two systems, the political formula, was originally devised to appeal to Taiwan. And so 1992 consensus, that's one China, respective interpretations, versus one country, two systems. And it is actually, I just think that you can't actually do the conceptual work of parsing out the two. And then the Han campaign also insisted, I think quite contradictorily, that it's actually the Tsai administration which would have one country, two systems realized in Taiwan somehow through offending China by pushing for some kind of more vaguely pro-independence political stance. And so this kind of intellectual contradiction, it couldn't resolve that. And I think that it just could not actually bridge those party lines. This was not going to appeal to actually people in the pan-green camper who might have to consider voting pan-green.
I think one thing that's worth going into is you mentioned these like nuances of like different positions towards China. Like the KMT is not actually advocating let's just join China again, right? So what is roughly their, like, what do people want if they vote KMT?
I think it's complex because I think that there's a lot of different ideological positions in the KMT at this point regarding what to do with China. I mean, just there's a notion of some kind of eventual unification with China. There's this general notion of economic reliance on China, that you need this for Taiwan's economy, for Taiwan to be stable and to be economically prosperous. But then I think if you actually ask the different members of the KMT, they have very different views. For example, party chair Hong Xiuzhu in 2016, I believe it was pushing for the replacement of the 1992 consensus with something she called an advanced version of the 1992 consensus, which was not one country respective interpretation, it was one country same interpretation. And this was read as kind of pushing for immediate unification. And so Han hasn't actually said immediate unification, but when you do talk to for example, KMT voters at a rally, you might actually ask them, well, what is your view on Hong Kong? And I mean, one response I heard was actually, well, you know, Hong Kong illustrates what happens when you rely too much on the US and not on China. And that's why you would have this situation now. I think that a lot of times it seems intellectually contradictory, but there's a lot of different layers there, I think, going on. It's very hard to understand as an ideology because I think there are just so many different versions of it now floating around.
Plus, I think it's I don't think we should understate just how prevalent ROC nationalism really is.
Can you characterize?
So ROC nationalism as in pride in the Republic of China and pride in being a Chinese citizen of the Republic of China. I think that's kind of the pan-blue voting base ideology. And I think that there's plenty of people within the KMT and deep blue people within the KMT that take that Republic of China pride and even, you know, expand it to saying, I am proud to be Chinese in the same way that my PRC family is proud to be Chinese. I think if you look at kind of some of the politicians on the KMT's party list, you see a lot of people that have no problem directly allying themselves with PRC government officials in this kind of unified China stance. So I think there is, you know, as a party, they won't directly say we are pro-unification, but as politicians, there are definitely politicians who in very not subtle ways articulate a very pro-unification stance. And meanwhile, from the DPP, there's just as much variation within what it means to be independence. I don't characterize the DPP as a pro-independence party, and I don't think most people should. I think the DPP and Tsai Ing-wen in particular are what we would refer to as pro-status quo. She has repeatedly said, especially in weeks up to the election, that she's the president of Zhonghua Minguo, of the ROC, not president of Taiwan or Taiwan Guo. And this matters. Not only does it matter, but it's actually written in the DPP's party constitution that the ruling government in Taiwan is ruling government of Zhonghua Minguo, and that if there's going to be any sort of change, it needs to be through public referendum, and that the DPP will not pursue any sort of immediate formal independence, and Tsai is also not going to do that. Tsai Ing-wen has, for the last 4 years, actually been very stable in terms of what she's done within the Cross Strait. She's pushed for no policy changes that would change Taiwan's status. She's done nothing to indicate that she wants to change Taiwan's status, its constitution, its name, any of kind of the big deal independence issues that you would think. Instead, she's perfectly fine being the president of the ROC and saying that, you know, as it exists, Taiwan is a de facto independent state. And she is okay with Taiwan being a de facto independent state without formal independence.
Yeah. I think that's helpful, especially for getting a sense of like what the two sides stand for. Kind of like having another look back at the campaign, you already mentioned both that it was very much not based on concrete policy proposals. And I've also heard people characterize this campaign as like very populist on both sides in some ways, but also heavily characterized by misinformation. So I'm curious whether this campaign was in any way notably different from other Taiwanese campaigns that you've seen in the past.
So I when people describe Tsai as populist, I don't think that's particularly accurate, or in the same way that we describe Han as populist. So we describe Han as populist for a couple of reasons. One, he's anti-elite. He claims that he is a spokesperson on behalf of the common people, and that he can define who the common people are, and that it is there's a very specific group of people in Taiwan that are the real Taiwanese, and that those other people aren't really in the service of Taiwan. And that's what makes him populist. Tsai doesn't do that. Tsai is not anti-elite. She doesn't claim that there is one set of people that are the real Taiwanese. Nor did she say that she is the only person who can speak on behalf of these real Taiwanese. People who say that Tsai is populist because she uses fear and emotions in her rhetoric, well, that's not populism, that's just politicking. What politician doesn't use fear and emotions in their politics? I think it's really these defining features that make Han populist don't really apply to Tsai. There's plenty to critique about Tsai, but I don't think it's from a populist angle.
Mm. Yeah, the KMT has this kind of internal discourse where they accuse the fact that there have been all these social movements in the past few years of being that are pro-Taiwan, that these are populist movements and that Tsai is leveraging on this. And so that's what they claim explicitly, that, you know, this is Tsai's populism. She's leveraging on the sense of national doom, which was a term people were saying to refer to the fear that Taiwan would lose its sovereignty entirely to China. And so though Han, I think, tried to depict Tsai as being a pro-independence diehard of manipulating young people, of stirring up emotions, which he himself is arguably actually the one doing, these accusations didn't really stick. And so there was that attempt. But I think that there is this kind of undercurrent of populism in Taiwanese politics, in which you do have these charismatic political leaders with inspired, very devoted followings. But that's also just generally politics, too.
Yeah, and also certainly not helped by the fact that presidents are directly elected and individuals have to style themselves as political leaders. I'm also curious how the whole misinformation aspect played into Taiwanese politics. So there was a lot of reporting both on misinformation operations coming from China, but also on misinformation within Taiwan, where there were a lot of rumors being thrown around by like both sides. How did that kind of like influence the campaign as you perceived it, also in comparison maybe to earlier ones?
Yeah, I think misinformation is one of those interesting, tricky questions, and disinformation, because there are obviously state actors which are out there and have that is to say China, that have an obvious incentive to creating disinformation about the Tsai administration to benefit the KMT, which is its political proxy in Taiwan. But it's often very hard to find a direct smoking gun for that. And if disinformation efforts are successful, then it shouldn't be so visible. But I think then actually you have a lot of discussion of memes circling through line groups. For example, the Wang Litiang case, when that took place, there were some odd rumors that began appearing that, oh, for example, Wang Litiang is not his real name. This is actually a fake name. So all these news reporting by Western media outlets, they're all wrong. Like, this is actually, that's actually something interesting, that there's these early reports that seem said this. And that seems to indicate some kind of misinformation, disinformation attempt out there on the internet and so forth. And there's sort of content farms that are targeting specific demographics and produce large amounts of content. And the issue then, though, I think the bigger issue might not actually be fake news. It's the fact that the mainstream media outlets in Taiwan are already, many of them are very skew towards China. And so they're actually kind of trying to keep negative reporting on China out of the news. For example, Hong Kong is discussed frequently by Western media, but a lot of these networks won't actually be reporting on it. It will be something that just comes up a little bit in the news, but it's not the main focus. And you still hear much more about just the kind of economic rise of China, or just this downplaying of negative facts about China. And so forth. But I think that's actually one of the things that's a little misleading about when we discuss disinformation. I think there's much more focus on controlling narratives rather than creating fake facts, for example, or fake news, quote unquote.
Actually, with the Wang Lixiang case, can you quickly explain what that was about? Because I think it was not that well reported outside of Australia and some very China-focused media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the Wang Lixiang case was a self-proclaimed defector who was seeking asylum in Australia, claimed that he had been involved in operations to influence the Taiwanese elections, as well as in Hong Kong. And so people point to irregularities with this story. For example, the fact that he's 26 years old, but seemed to hold a pretty high senior position, that he was able to work in these different operations in multiple theaters. But this was focused in a lot by the DPP as a way of claiming that China is involved in efforts to influence Taiwanese elections. Han, that he kind of rose out of obscurity to superstardom overnight. Many people will actually claim that's the result of Chinese efforts to prop him up as a candidate. Because, for example, his kind of Google search ratings just surged overnight. He became much more searched than even Ko Wen-je, the highly popular mayor of Taipei at that point in time. I mean, popular then, not so much now. But then the people will say that this is an effort by China to prop up a candidate. And so again, it's very hard to have actually direct proof of that, but people point to this. And so that came up. That's when the DPP used as a talking point against the KMT. And there was an incident in which Alex Tsai, a former KMT legislator, was reported as having threatened to kill Wang Lixiang if he didn't make a video of himself recanting his claims and saying that the DPP had paid him to do that. On the other hand, if he made this video, he'd be allowed to stay in Taiwan and possibly even return to China safely. And
he was trying to get asylum in Australia.
That's right. Yeah. And so the claim would be that he would instead have some kind of asylum in Taiwan, or that the KMT would negotiate with the CCP to allow him to re-enter China. And so then that came up very late in the race, just a few days before. And that was one of these kind of last minute wrinkles in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back on disinformation real quick. I think one of the other comparative cases that we have to think about in Taiwan is how disinformation and misinformation was used last year during the midterm. Especially in regards to same-sex marriage and the marriage equality referendums that happened. So marriage equality fake news, last election when marriage equality fake news was coming out, I think that was really the first time the internet became such a talked about subject in Taiwanese politics in regards to fake news, because homophobic groups, anti-same-sex marriage groups all utilized fake news, fake reports, fake science, and spread all over Taiwan through private line groups, through private chat groups, to try to convince people to not support same-sex marriage. And I think, they were very successful. So last year, 7 million people voted against same-sex marriage, and only 3 million people voted in favor of same-sex marriage. And that's the result of this massive disinformation campaign. And this disinformation campaign did not come from China, because I don't think China is particularly invested in how Taiwanese people feel about same-sex marriage. But that's not to say that, you know, this election, it wasn't. I think rather what last election shows was just exactly how vulnerable Taiwan can be to disinformation. And I think the same-sex marriage disinformation campaign was both assigned to certain groups that look at how easy and how successful disinformation can be in Taiwan. But I think it was also a wake-up call for this election, because I think, unlike last election, people this time were well-prepared. Well, I shouldn't say well-prepared, were prepared, and were at least paying attention and watching for it in a way that people were most certainly not before this election.
Mm. And I think that disinformation efforts are also getting more sophisticated as time goes on. And so that's actually maybe even the danger, that right now they aren't sophisticated enough to actually concrete influence the outcome of elections in this way. For example, in the past, China was actually producing disinformation itself, but then that was too easily readable as being from China, because Chinese grammar and the way they use, they write the characters or common phrases are sometimes different. And so now there's the turn towards using Taiwanese proxies, for example. People that are Taiwanese are just taking contracts from China to produce content, maybe that China writes a script and they kind of localize it, because then they are Taiwanese. And so the way they talk is Taiwanese. And so it's actually very hard to point to this as from coming from the outside. And I think there's also the difference between individual efforts at creating disinformation, or which are more confined to small groups creating it, or just larger systematic attempts to create disinformation, in which you do have different groups, for example, coordinating and creating different kinds of sets of information that are supposed to align in some way. And so I think that we actually, I think the right now we do see a lot of these kind of individual things that spread that are created even just maybe by one person, a picture and text, for example. That's very easy to make. But then the more sophisticated efforts, then it's hard to point to, again, just direct proof. Is this actually coming from China? And so, yeah.
Yeah. One thing that I also wanted to come back to is that you both mentioned the frequent use of Hong Kong and references to Hong Kong and the Tsai campaign. Is this going to translate into any meaningful kind of like new policy now that she was reelected? Like, does this have real implications for how she's going to rule? Like, there has been, for example, discussions of a possible asylum law, like it was as a way of improving the legal status of Hong Kong protesters who flee to Taiwan. So is this election rhetoric going to translate into any concrete policy initiatives now?
No. I think there's definitely potential that there will be some backlash because Tsai has doubled down on Hong Kong so much this election. At the same time, she has said repeatedly that she has no intention of changing or creating any new laws for Hong Kongers. And whether or not people will be upset at the fact that she utilized Hong Kong for her electoral strategy so much and then is going to probably proceed to do nothing actually for Hong Kong. People might get upset. People might not really care. I also think it's important that when we think about when people or politicians or parties use Hong Kong to try to mobilize or inspire voters, there's definitely a qualitative difference, I think, when Taiwanese people see Hong Kong and say, ooh, that's rough. I don't want that here. I'm going to vote for the DPP, and saying, ooh, that's rough. We should do something to help them. Like, I don't think that by using Hong Kong that it's necessarily causing Taiwanese citizens to want to actually help Hong Kong, which might sound cruel or kind of mean, but I don't think Taiwanese voters particularly care about passing legislation to help Hong Kong. I just think Taiwanese voters don't want Taiwan to become Hong Kong.
Yeah, and I think that without pressure from civil society, domestic Taiwanese civil society, there will not be action on this. But then I think the majority of Taiwanese society probably will not really care too much. And I think that the Tsai administration has backed down from previous rhetoric saying that it would help Hong Kongers and attempted to redirect Hong Kongers to the existing channels. And that is just basically saying that she doesn't want to do anything. At the same time, I think there's the possibility for this to come up in the news again, because on the Hong Kong side, the Hong Kong activists have generally decided to sideline the issue until after the election because they didn't think that there was a chance of actually any action being taken by the Tsai administration. So I think it's possible that there will actually be action on that front from the Hong Kong side to raise awareness of this being an issue still. And then this might be an issue that will open up splits within DPP, particularly because of the younger, kind of more progressive activists that align with the DPP and join the DPP in order to form a kind of united front against the KMT, just to ensure that there was not a KMT victory. This might be an issue when she sees splits again.
One thing, I know, Brian, you have to leave soon-ish. Just one more thing that I wanted to ask about where we're going from here is that one thing I've heard repeatedly is that, oh, the campaign was like, Taiwanese society is like very polarized, and that especially the way the campaign was done on both sides is something that made people like not talk to each other anymore. There were like people would like regularly accuse people from the other political camp of like being brainwashed. Like that's something pretty common. Is that something that's just going to like go away now that the campaign is over? And also, was this even unusual in terms of how the campaign impacted polarization in Taiwan?
I think it's becoming increasingly common as time goes on. I think this rhetoric we've seen for basically the last 6 years, particularly after the Sunflower Movement, the youth-led occupation of the Taiwanese legislature for a month. Since then until now, there's always been talk of intergenerational conflict between younger voters who identify as Taiwanese, who are more likely to vote for the pan-green camp, and their parents, who may be pan-blue and may identify with China in some form. And so you have this talk of that you will have these frequent family fights, that many families don't talk to each other anymore. There have even been some people that had to leave home because their parents are Han fans and refuse the fact that accept that their children vote differently. And I think this is just going to be increasingly an issue as time goes on, because these splits are not going to come together anytime soon. They're not going to heal. And as long as the KMT exists, and as long as there's a demographic that has this political view that calls for Taiwan to become part of China, you're always going to have these conflicts. And I think that there will be just, this is maybe a generational political issue.
I think this is normal, and I think it's reflective about polarization across the world right now. I think especially when you have more and more disinformation campaigns, I think there's definitely something to be researched about the way that disinformation leads to more polarization, because when both sides have news sources saying the other one is XYZ, I think it just makes people further convinced that they're right and the other person's wrong, and anything they say otherwise is ludicrous. And I think that's just going to cause people to become more and more polarized over time.
Okay, now Brian has left. Lev is still here. So before we wrap up, I wanted to use the time to talk to you about third parties, because you mentioned in the very beginning that in the party list vote, the KMT and the DPP, so the two big parties, got roughly 30% respectively, but also a third of voters voted for other parties. So can you talk to us a bit about what that was about?
So third parties getting 30% of the party vote tells us a few things. The biggest thing it tells us is that Taiwanese voters most certainly want other options than just the KMT and the DPP. That's not to say that there's some sort of new post-green-blue ideology that's becoming really pervasive, but I think it shows a genuine lack of, I think it shows genuine discontent, at least, with both the DPP and the KMT over different things. The rise of third parties has been going on for a while. There's this specific cohort of third force parties that formed out of the Sunflower Movement. But there's still other third parties that have formed since then or that have already been in existence. So the big players this election were the New Power Party, which formed during the Sunflower Movement, the Taiwan State Building Party, which formed as a party in 2016, but as an organization has existed much longer. And then the Taiwan People's Party, which is the new political party of Taipei Mayor Kowenja. And there is a fourth small party that's worth noting, the People's First Party, James Song's party. They still got 3.6% of the votes, which gives them enough for party funding, which shows that they're still around. But those are more likely to be read as protest KMT votes more than any sort of than anything else. So to start, the New Power Party, in 2016, they won three district elections and they got 6.5% of the party vote, which was very good for them for being a brand new party. This election, they lost all their single member district races, but they got 7.5% of the party vote. So they got a percentage more this election than last election. And that might seem small, but when you're a small party in Taiwan, 1% is a very big difference. So they'll still have three legislatures in the Li Fa-yuan. Kowenja's party got 11%. And their party also is very new. Now, Kowenja's party is not part of the post-Sunflower party cohort. The most notable way we know this is because they're not a pro-independence nor a pro-progressive social policy party.
As opposed to the NPP.
As opposed to the NPP. In fact, we don't really know anything about what the TPP stands for as of now. Their initial appeal was to try to seem to be a radical centrist party. I'm using the word radical ironically here. It's not radical at all. They said that they are above independence unification and that they are going to focus on other issues. And what exactly those other issues are is still kind of yet to be seen. They've taken a lot of very ambiguous stances about current contemporary problems. So, for example, when asked their stance on same-sex marriage, they said, "We have no opinion." And that might have worked for the first 6 months. But I think, a lot of us politics watchers, myself included, are very eager for voters or politicians to kind of hold their feet to the fire so that we can get a better understanding of what exactly their stances are. We have a couple of indications. So first, Kowenja himself has, over the last year or two, become more and more progressively pan-blue rather than pan-green. He started off pan-green, but over time, he's made a lot more statements that indicate he's much more pro-China than we initially thought. And the second is Terry Goh, the CEO of Foxconn, the company that makes everyone's iPhones, has endorsed Kowenja's party and endorsed most of Kowenja's candidates. So Terry Goh, who, is a regular contact of Li Keqiang in the CCP, whose business is a very big player in the CCP economy and Taiwan economy, if someone like him is endorsing a political party, then I don't think it's particularly accurate to describe that party as above green-blue politics. I would say that makes that party at least a little bit blue. So a lot of us right now are starting to read Kowenja's party as blue, not KMT blue, but definitely at least light blue. And I suspect it will continue to get more and more blue as time goes on.
You also mentioned state building, which got like a lot of attention because they managed to get one directly elected candidate into the legislative yuan. What do they stand for?
So the Taiwan State Building Party started out as a political organization called the Taiwan Radical Wings, formed in Kaohsiung years ago, before Sunflower even. They've been around for quite some time. But they were just a political organization that was pro-Taiwan independence. And that was really their stance. They're an anti-CCP party, a pro-Taiwan independence party, very typical of most other third force parties. They're also they're now much more articulate about their progressive social values, but for the longest time, they're mostly just a pro-independence party. They only became a party in late 2016, early 2017. And they didn't actually even run in 2016 as a party. Instead, their party chair was put on the Taiwan Solidarity Alliance's party list. So this election, they finally came out as a party and wanted to throw their hat in the ring as another option for third force post-Sunflower progressive parties. Now, the expectation was they had a really strong campaign. The expectation was that they would break 3.5% of the party list vote, and that 3.5% number matters because that's the number at which you get state funding. And it was expected that their star politician, whose name is Chen Bowei, who was running in Taizong against a very long-held KMT seat, was going to lose. It wasn't just thought that he was going to lose. It was, of all the third-party candidates, that was the one that no one was even bothering to talk about because it was such a sure thing that he was going to lose. Now, the exact opposite happened. State Building Party didn't get 3.5% of the vote. They got 3.1%. And Chen Bowei won by a lot. So he will be in parliament. This Taiwan State Building Party has allied themselves with the DPP as an electoral strategy for this last election. And going forward, we'll have to see what exactly that relationship looks like. It's not a sure thing that they will continue this relationship. It's not a sure thing that Chen Bowei will continue to advocate for the DPP or that the DPP will continue to advocate for the State Building Party. But it's definitely something to watch going forward.
I think beyond that, is there anything else that was interesting about the legislative yuan race that you think is worth pointing out?
For those who are watching small third force parties last election, there's one other name that's worth noting, which is Fan Yun. So she was the founder of the Social Democratic Party, one of the other big third force parties that formed out of the Sunflower Movement. And her party did not even run at all this election. The reason being is because the DPP offered to put her, the Social Democratic Party party chair, on their party list. And this did two things. First, it eliminated a competing party for pro-Taiwan votes. And also, it gave the Social Democratic Party a guaranteed candidate into office, which is it's definitely a win-win, but it's a much bigger win for Fan Yun, who has tried to run repeatedly and lost every time. So for all you third force politics people, that's the other big name to pay attention to. So essentially, the Social Democratic Party is no longer relevant. I'm not sure I would describe it as totally dead because I think Fan Yun is still clinging on to the title, but she herself is effectively a DPP politician now.
Going forward, paying attention. So if people are going to keep paying attention to Taiwanese politics over the next few months, what are kind of like the things to look out for that are going to be interesting in terms of what are the big questions now with how things are going to continue? And also, I guess, with an eye towards the next elections in
24.
Yeah.
So my attitude is that the DPP, given how they performed the last 4 years, is not a very strong policy party. They try to push for progressive policy, but they tend to end up pushing for fairly lukewarm policy. So I don't exactly anticipate any sort of major change happening in the short run. The DPP says they have all these great grand plans to help booster Taiwan's sovereignty and for reform, and that's great. I hope they do. But until I see the policy proposals, I will keep my expectations to where they currently are, which is fairly low. Really, the next big thing in my mind for Taiwan politics is the American election, because that will redefine not just the U.S.-Taiwan relationship, but the U.S.-China relationship and the U.S.-China-Taiwan trilateral relationship. And the reason this is interesting is because every time there is a Republican in the White House, there is a DPP president in Taiwan. And every time there's a Democrat in the White House, there's a KMT president in Taiwan. So in the event that Donald Trump does not get reelected and there's a DPP president in the US, it will actually be totally uncharted territory for the Taiwan-US relationship because there's never been a DPP and Democrat president at the same time.
Why does this matter? Like, what could be interesting? Like, what kind of potential does that create?
So it matters because Democrats typically are not as quote unquote hard on China as Republicans are. And even though Democrats have a good productive relationship with Taiwan, I anticipate that the rate or way in which the U.S. sells or approaches its military relationship with Taiwan will vary under a Democratic president.
What's going to happen with the KMT now?
So there's currently the KMT party chair election to watch, but that's so that there's going to be an interim chair for the next year because Wu Dunyi stepped down, and so they'll have their formal party chair replacement next year. 4 years ago when Zhu Lilun lost really badly, every headline said like the KMT needs reform immediately. And in the last week, every newspaper has said after Han Kuo-yu's loss, the KMT needs reform immediately. So we'll see. Because the KMT still did as well as they did, I think there's definitely plenty of people in the KMT that don't necessarily see the need for change. I think they just see the need for a better candidate next time. I think they're still figuring out who their winning strategy is as a presidential candidate.
Okay, great. Anything you want to add?
I'll stop there.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for making time. And as always, we'll link both yours and Brian's online presence in the show notes. And thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, hier nochmal Katharin. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Ich schalte mich hier nochmal kurz rein mit einer Ansage und etwas Bonus-Content zum Ende, direkt aus Taiwan. Kurz erst zur Ansage. Wie immer freuen wir uns, wenn ihr unsere Arbeit finanziell unterstützen wollt, sei es durch einmalige Spenden oder durch regelmäßige Spenden. Einmalig könnt ihr uns gerne bei PayPal Sachen schicken, über paypal.me/fernostwärts. Ihr könnt uns auch regelmäßig unterstützen, sei es über Steady, wo ihr so monatliche Mitgliedschaften abschließen könnt oder einfach ganz simpel per Dauerüberweisung oder auch per Einmalüberweisung auf unser Bankkonto, das wir in den Shownotes wie immer verlinkt haben. Außerdem wollte ich euch nochmal darauf hinweisen, dass wir mittlerweile auch den Fernostwärts-Newsletter betreiben, in dem wir alle 2 Wochen über aktuelle Nachrichten aus China, Hongkong und Taiwan schreiben. Die aktuelle Ausgabe ist am Mittwoch, also gestern rausgekommen. Normalerweise kommt er aber alle 2 Wochen. Das heißt, alle 2 Wochen montags gibt es von uns einmal eine Zusammenfassung der wichtigsten Nachrichten aus Ostasien auf Deutsch. Die Adresse direkt zum Newsletter ist fernostwärts.substack.com und wie immer ist das auch in den Shownotes wieder verlinkt. Zum Letzten, was Ansagen angeht, unsere nächste Folge wird in ein paar Tagen rauskommen, und zwar am 5. Februar, also dem Mittwoch. Wir veröffentlichen jetzt ja eigentlich immer eine Folge am ersten Mittwoch des Monats. Die Folge zu Taiwan haben wir jetzt vorgezogen, weil es aktuell war und bevor Leute das mit den Wahlen vergessen. Aber am 5. Februar kommt unsere nächste Folge, da wird es um den aktuellen Zustand der Protestbewegung in Hongkong gehen. Von daher könnt ihr euch darauf schon mal freuen. So, Bonus-Content. Ich war ja selber vor den Wahlen und auch während der Wahlen in Taiwan und war sehr davon beeindruckt, was für eine Erfahrung das war, in diesem Wahlkampf irgendwie teilzunehmen. Also taiwanesischer Wahlkampf hat unter anderem riesige, große Wahlkampfveranstaltungen, bei denen Leute hingehen, irgendwie Lieder singen, Slogans rufen, solche Sachen. Die Leute machen auch richtig mit. Das war auch richtig das Krasse. Also ich glaube, in Deutschland, wenn sich so ein Politiker vorne hinstellt und versucht, so einen Sprechgesang zu machen, die meisten würden wahrscheinlich eher so ein bisschen blöd gucken. Aber in Taiwan ist das total normal. Es spielt auch im Hintergrund ganz viel dramatische Musik. Und deswegen habe ich euch jetzt noch ein paar Audio-Eindrücke vom Wahlkampf mitgebracht und von den Wahlen selber, die wir euch hier jetzt noch kurz einspielen wollten. Es geht los mit einem kleinen Eindruck von der letzten Wahlkampfveranstaltung der DPP, also Tsai Ing-wens Partei, am Abend vor der Wahl. Und was ganz spannend ist, ist, also man hört, wie da so Sprechgesänge gemacht werden. Und was ganz witzig ist, wenn ihr da zuhört, dann hört ihr so Dungshorn, dass die Leute Dungshorn rufen. Das ist auf Mandarin heißt das gefrorener Knoblauch, aber auf Taiwanesisch, also einem Dialekt, der in Taiwan oft gesprochen wird, heißt es gewählt werden. Und weil das auf Taiwanesisch besser und stärker und energetischer klingt, wird es auf diesen Wahlveranstaltungen immer auf Taiwanesisch gerufen. Der zweite Clip, den ich für euch habe, ist von der Stimmauszählung in Taiwan. Ich war am Samstag, als die Wahlen stattfanden und nachdem die Wahllokale geschlossen hatten, habe ich mich in einer öffentlichen Schule hinten reingesetzt, in einen Raum, wo die Stimmen gezählt wurden und ein bisschen dabei zugeschaut, weil der gesamte Prozess komplett öffentlich ist. Also man hört das auch in dem Clip ganz gut. Es wurden in dem Wahlbüro gleichzeitig die Präsidentschaftsstimmen und die Stimmen für die Direktkandidatur von dem Distrikt ausgezählt. Und was passiert ist, dass eine Person quasi den Wahlzettel hochhält, damit die Leute, die hinten sitzen und das beobachten, sehen können, welche Box angekreuzt wurde. Und dann einer Person, die vorne an einer Tafel quasi so einen Strich macht, zuruft, für wen die Stimme ist. Und so werden Stimmen auf eine Art und Weise gezählt, die komplett transparent sind und wo auch, wenn jemand einen Fehler macht, dann gibt es keinen langen Prozess oder irgendwie einen Eintrag, was man machen muss, sondern dann rufen die ganzen Leute, die hinten drin sitzen, der Person zu, ah, du hast einen Fehler gemacht, das ist so falsch gemacht. Dann wird es sofort korrigiert. Und das ist unter anderem, besteht dieses System eben wegen Taiwans autokratischer Vergangenheit. Also Taiwan ist ja erst seit den Mitte der 90er Jahre eine Demokratie. Und dieses System existiert unter anderem, um sicherzugehen, dass der Stimmzählprozess vollkommen transparent ist und auch um sicherzugehen, dass die Leute dem Prozess trauen. Genau, das heißt hier jetzt noch kurz Audio aus dem Wahllokal, wo man hört, wie die Stimmen ausgezählt werden. Also man hört dann immer Hangul, Zhaingun und zwischendurch hört man noch James Sung, der auch angetreten ist mit den beiden.
6号林奕华一票，3号林奕华一票，5号票1张，谢佩芬一票，6号谢佩芬一票，6号谢佩芬一票，3号林奕华一票，3号林奕华一票，3号宋楚瑜一票，3号林奕华一票，3号林奕华一票。
无效票1张，6号刘谢佩芬一票，2号韩国瑜一票，6号谢佩芬一票，3号蔡英文一票，6号谢佩芬一票，2号韩国瑜一票，3号林奕华一票，2号韩国瑜一票，6号谢佩芬一票，2号韩国瑜一票。
Sonst als allerletztes zum Ende dann noch ein kurzer Eindruck von der letzten Wahlkampfveranstaltung der DPP. Also eigentlich nicht mehr Wahlkampf, sondern eher so eine Feier, wo gefeiert wurde, dass Tsai Ing-wen wiedergewählt wurde. Es war ziemlich krass, weil bei der Veranstaltung wirklich unheimlich viele junge Leute waren. Das war wirklich besonders beeindruckend. Was gerade beeindruckend ist angesichts der niedrigen Wahlraten unter jungen Leuten in vielen Ländern und eben auch in Taiwan. Und die haben quasi auf der Veranstaltung wurde dann immer so hochgezählt, also während die Stimmen ausgezählt wurden, haben sie im Endeffekt mitgezählt, wie viele Stimmen hat Tsai Ing-wen jetzt offiziell. Und als sie dann erst die 7 Millionen und dann die 8 Millionen geknackt hat, sind die Leute alle total ausgerastet. Das war schon ziemlich krass. Und da gab es natürlich auch wieder Dongsuan, also gefrorene Knoblauchgerufe. Und was auch ganz interessant war, ist, dass sie für jede Direktkandidatur, die Partei errungen hat, wurde die Person quasi einmal angezeigt und es wurde gefeiert. Und das ist der Teil, den jetzt noch, man hört so das Ende von so ein paar Dongsuan rufen und danach hört man dann kurz ein paar Ansagen und den Jubel für bestimmte Direktkandidaturen, wo man dann auch so merkt, welche Leute so ein bisschen beliebter sind. Danke, dass ihr euch die extra Sachen hier jetzt noch angehört habt und wie immer, vielen Dank nochmal fürs Zuhören. Wir freuen uns wie immer über Feedback, sei es positiv oder negativ, schickt uns eine E-Mail, schickt uns Tweets, kommentiert unter den Folgen, sagt, was ihr gut fandet, sagt, was ihr schlecht fandet. Konstruktive Kritik ist immer willkommen und genau, in diesem Sinne, bis nächste Woche.